42, Gerald McKenzie versus Miller Brewing Company et al. And I will announce that Justice Patrick Crooks will not be participating in this case, and I think the parties have been advised of that. So we will first hear from Michael A. Whitcomb, representing Mr. McKenzie.
May it please the Court, my name is Michael Whitcomb. I represent the petitioner before this Court, Gerald McKenzie. Also with me at counsel table representing Mr. McKenzie and lead trial counsel in the case, Mr. Gerald Boyle.
Mr. Whitcomb, we usually have a five-minute rule here where nobody interrupts you and gives you 5 minutes, but I'm going to break the rule today.
Go for it.
All right. What I'm going to do is ask you to state the claims, the cause of action that are at issue here. And what I mean by that is, and then you can proceed, assuming I get the first one right, you can check. One, you have an intentional misrepresentation claim against Smith and Miller Brewing.
Correct.
Right?
Subdivided, if you will, the claim against Miller as presented to the jury by the special verdict question was a failure to disclose intentional misrepresentation.
Okay. And against Smith?
It was phrased in a generic question in the special verdict, did Mr. Smith make a misrepresentation of fact? So the jury, in his case, could either have determined he made an outright misstatement or he failed to disclose.
All right. And the damages awarded were?
Damages were awarded against Miller Brewing Company in the amount of $6,500,000 and $1,500 in compensatory.
All right.
And in punitive damages in the amount of $8 million were awarded.
Okay. And against Smith?
The compensatory damages were awarded in the amount of $500,000 by the jury, subsequently reduced by the trial court, which was accepted by Mr. McKenzie, to $100,000, and a compensatory damage award of $1,500.
So the punitive was $500,000 reduced to $100,000 against Smith, with compensatory $1,500.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, because you originally said compensatory, but you meant that. Okay. Now, what was the $100,000 against Mr. Smith in the special verdict?
That was for the intentional misrepresentation.
Okay. Well, interference with
correct.
So against Smith, that's why we're asking these questions. So against Smith, it was also another cause of action was interference with
prospective contract.
Prospective contract. That was the promotion.
Correct.
Okay. All right. And that was $100,000. And that's in dispute, too. All of these are in dispute, right?
The claim as regards Mr. Smith, the intentional interference with contract, our petition for review did not address that claim.
Okay. So that is not, so you lost that because the Court of Appeals held against you.
That
is not before us. Okay.
That is correct.
All right. Now, what about the claim against
Patricia
Best? Best.
Mm-hmm. In that instance, the award by the jury was $1.5 million in punitives with no compensatory damages awarded.
And the claim was?
Intentional interference with contract.
By?
Ms. Best.
By Ms. Best, by intentionally charging sexual harassment or?
Correct.
Do we have it all now?
You do, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor, I know it's not very good at all, but I believe there's a mistake. I think two of the M's was $18 million.
Yes.
$18, yeah. Because that would make the 25.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Daly. Ms. Justice Babbage has a question.
Yes, following these questions by the Chief, I want to concentrate on the first two, the one about the Smith was liable for intentional misrepresentation. Miller was found liable for failing to disclose. Let me put it in a hypothetical to get at the point that I'm making, because I'm confused by those two. First of all, it seems to me that it was declared or resolved at trial that at all times Smith was acting as an agent for Miller. So I'm wondering why, if Smith was found liable for intentional misrepresentation with damages of $500,000, why wouldn't Miller also be liable for that? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Well, I believe the distinction is the timing of the misrepresentations, as which could be reasonably found by the jury. In the first instance, as the testimony presented in 1987, Mr. McKenzie asked Mr. Smith as to whether or not his position would be affected by a reorganization, to which...
Let me put it another way.
Okay.
Let me put it another, because I know that I bollocks the first time.
That's fine.
Is the claim for failing to disclose made against Miller a part and parcel of the claim of intentional misrepresentation?
Yes.
It is.
It is an intentional misrepresentation claim.
Okay. So the intentional misrepresentation claim against Smith was a verbal intentional misrepresentation, and the intentional misrepresentation claim against Miller was for failing to disclose.
Correct. However, pursuant to the jury instructions that were provided, that as it related to Mr. Smith, the jury could have also concluded as to the claim against him that his liability also was attributable to failure to disclose.
So failing to disclose, you're saying that failing to disclose is part of the intentional misrepresentation.
Against Mr. Smith?
Against Miller.
Yes, you mean the specific verdict question asked that.
It's part of it with regard to both, isn't it? Your failure to disclose, which is part of your intentional misrepresentation claim, is part of the claim against Miller and is part of the claim against Smith.
It's definitely against Miller. The jury could have made a finding of failure to disclose against Smith.
Or a misstatement.
A lie, right.
Let me jump ahead. Let's assume for the moment that we find that there was credible evidence in this record that there was an intentional misrepresentation by Smith. But we do not find that there's credible evidence, or maybe by law, that we find that there is no action here for failing to disclose. You end up with $500,000, but not the $18 million then, correct?
That would be correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Okay, now let's give them his five.
Pretty soon it becomes real money.
But wasn't that $500,000 reduced?
Yes.
Yes.
So it's $100,000.
All right. You may proceed as you might have.
Thank you. I see presented before this court three public policy legal philosophical issues. The first is which I think was best presented by Judge Wiedemeyer in a question during oral argument to my respected opponents, and that is there anywhere in the law where there is a right to do a wrong? In this instance, to accept the premise that the commission of an intentional tort in an employment context must be excused or should be excused in any way. I think what, in fact, what the court would be doing and what the Court of Appeals did was created a public policy exception for intentional torts. And that is unprecedented, certainly in the state of Wisconsin. The second principal issue before this court, which we ask you to exemplify in this particular case, is to highlight once again the sanctity of civil jury verdicts. All too often, I believe that appellate courts are being placed in the position of having literally to retry the facts in cases that are brought before them, which in effect, and which in fact happened in this case. I think returning the sanctity to jury verdicts, that jury verdicts will not withstand challenge but for serious and prejudicial procedural error, I think this case presents that opportunity to this court to reinforce the sanctity of juries.
Are you suggesting, and I note that the Court of Appeals went over the evidence, are you suggesting how would one review, when you talk about sanctity, what review is there then without the court going over the verdict and the testimony? Talking about the appellate court.
I think what an appellate court should do is should take the record as presented to it, look at the evidence most favorable in the best light to the prevailing party, and arrive at a quick conclusion that the evidence sustains the verdict. Especially as we have in this case, that the verdict by the jury was approved by the trial court in a very well-reasoned decision.
I was going to say that is a normal review. In other words, if it's a de novo review, the Court of Appeals, as they did in this case, went over the testimony and came to some conclusions. And I'm just asking, when you talk about the sanctity of the jury, there's the tension between an adequate review.
That is correct, Your Honor, but in all due respect to the Court of Appeals in this case, I believe they overstepped the bounds, at least the lead opinion did, and assumed the role of the finder of fact. And I believe Judge Wiedemeyer also arrived at that same conclusion. I mean, in the particular case, I believe that the lead opinion was in fact weighing the evidence, and that is certainly not the role of the Court of Appeals.
The lead opinion didn't need to get to any evidence at all, though, did it, in order to sustain it for its holding? I mean, as I recall reading it, and it's been a while, it first addressed the issue as a matter of law and then said, we don't need to get to the sufficiency of evidence question having answered the issue as a matter of law, but we'll do so anyway.
That is correct. As to the misrepresentation claims, once the court ruled, based upon its understanding of the Tatke decision, that there's no such thing as torts anymore in the employment context, there wasn't any reason to get into the evidentiary analysis it conducted on the misrepresentation claims.
Well, talking about the sanctity of the jury verdict, then, what is it in the record that you believe constitutes the failure to disclose on the part of Miller? And where does that duty as a matter of law arise?
From the record or as a matter of law?
From the record, what are your facts that you rely on? That's the first question. The second question is, maybe you can take them in either order that you want, where is the legal duty to disclose on behalf of Miller? Give me the facts first.
All right. Mr. McKenzie in 1987 asked his immediate supervisor, Mr. Robert Smith, as to whether or not a reorganization at the company that was occurring at the time would affect him, would cause him to be downgraded, because he was told by Mr. Smith that the staff that reported to him would be reduced substantially and a major area of his responsibility would be transferred to another individual.
Your claim is that Smith intentionally misrepresented at that time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so that's the intentional misrepresentation.
That is correct.
That was an affirmative act.
Correct, Your Honor.
Now, we've got silence also, which by Miller, apparently.
That is correct.
Okay, and what is that? What facts constitute that?
Well, he was never told, either by Mr. Smith in 1987 or by Miller, commencing in 1988, there was
We're familiar with those facts.
Now, Mr. Whitcomb, let me just stop you. In 87, when Smith said that the reorganization didn't affect the grade level, was that a true response when he said no?
It was not a true response.
In 87, he had been, the grade had been changed?
No, Your Honor.
No, I didn't think the grade had been changed until 92.
Well, the downgrade took effect in 1989.
Okay, sorry, 1989. But he didn't ask in 1989, did he?
He did not, Your Honor.
And he was advised that others who were under his supervision jobs had been downgraded.
That is correct.
Okay.
Now, given if we can finish my question here.
So in 87, that's the point. Right. He was not downgraded.
So you claim that the intentional misrepresentation must have occurred in 1989.
I'm in a difficult position because you're asking me basically to determine what the jury might have found. What we believe, and what I personally believe, that in 1987, Smith knew he would be downgraded, and when Mr. McKenzie asked him, he lied to him. That is established in the evidence not only by their answer to the complaint where that statement was made by them, but also in their interrogatory answer by Mr. Smith. Right. The fact that Mr. Smith changed it around when he was on the witness stand creates a great deal of confusion in this case. If you're asking me,
John,
the facts in the record, I can recite the facts as...
I understand that, counsel. What I'm getting at is, I'm trying to get at this failure to disclose as your theory of law here. Now, if there was a failure to disclose, there had to be a duty on the part of Miller to disclose, a legal duty. Where do you find that legal duty in the law?
The jury found it, Your Honor. A duty.
The jury can't find that as a matter of law, counsel. That's one of the legal questions that we have to answer here, which is whether or not Miller had a legal duty to disclose to Mr. McKenzie whether he was being downgraded.
According to the Allerman decision, the question of a duty is a question of law only when the facts are undisputed. When the facts are disputed, which they clearly were in this case, there's differing testimony as to whether or not an executive should be told when his status is going to be affected or his position is going to be downgraded. According to Allerman,
can you cite any case that says that an employer has a duty to disclose this kind of information to an employee? Is there any case upon which you are relying?
I'm not aware of any case where a duty has been found by a court or by a jury, if you will, that an employer had a duty to disclose to its employee that its position has been downgraded.
So my question would be in this is that when you're asking us to create a duty of disclosure at this through public policy, is that correct?
No, I'm not, Your Honor.
Well, then what?
I'm asking the court to accept the verdict as found by the jury.
Okay.
And that in the instructions to the jury, in answering the first question to Miller Brewing, they were asked to determine whether or not silence constituted misrepresentation, and the instructions provided that silence can be a misrepresentation, if you will, if you find there's a duty to disclose the information requested. And then the instruction further goes on that duty may be found by you in the event information is asked for. There is a relationship between the parties that would call for an honest response, or if if the parties were in a fiduciary relationship. Not saying that this court in its decision would be imposing a duty to disclose upon anyone. What I'm saying is that the jury verdict should be upheld, and the legal principle is that they found intentional misrepresentation, at least as to Miller, for non-disclosure in an employment setting.
I'm just trying to balance this disclosure, which seems to be an open-ended consideration. That's all I was asking.
Well, not as it relates to liability. Fraud is one of the most difficult things in the civil law to prove. In fraud, you not only have the elements of injury, reliance, and intent. I'm talking about intentional fraud. You also have the strict statutory pleading requirements with particularity. And thirdly, you have the higher middle ground burden of proof in order to establish it. And in all instances, we met that in this particular case with Mr. McKenzie's claim of intentional misrepresentation against Miller.
Okay, let's see if we can sort this out. From what you've said, and I have not read the two boxes of the record, which I'm sure doesn't surprise you, counsel. Haven't read them yet. The jury was instructed, if I understood you, that a duty to disclose the downgrade arose from the facts that, if accepted by the jury, McKenzie asked whether he had been downgraded, that Smith gave him information which the jury could have believed was wrong. Is that right? Am I doing it right so far?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Okay. And that after Smith gave information that was wrong, nobody corrected this wrong information.
That is correct.
And that from those facts, plus the employment relationship, the jury could find that there was a duty on the part of Miller to disclose the true facts of the employment.
Correct. If I have the record before me as to the jury instruction. I can read it verbatim as given by the trial court. This relates to the claim against Miller. A representation of fact does not have to be in writing or by word or of mouth, but it may be by acts of conduct on the part of Miller Brewing Company, or even by silence if there is a duty to speak. A duty to speak may arise when information is asked for or when circumstances would call for response in order that the parties may be put on equal footing. A representation by silence is to be tested by the actual influence on the person to whom made. Thirdly, the jury must find as the third element of intentional misrepresentation, quote, thirdly, that Miller Brewing Company knowingly was silent when it had a duty to speak, or recklessly was silent without caring whether it had a duty to speak.
Okay. And I believe, was there any objection to that instruction?
No, these are the standard boilerplate 2401 intentional misrepresentation instruction.
Well, it's not boilerplate 2401, but it was close.
It was adapted to the facts of the case, but there weren't any modifications as to the representations of law.
This is a problem I have. In the discussion, you were saying duty to disclose. Aren't you really characterizing this as a duty not to misrepresent, as a duty under 2401 not to engage in intentional deceit?
Correct.
And in this case, you are saying the intentional deceit is a failure to disclose. So you're not talking about, correct me.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor.
You're not talking about, is there a, duty breach, cause. You're not talking about, is there a duty in the law to inform?
No.
But you're asking, I think you're talking about, is there a, your cause of action is under 2401, misrepresentation, which has the elements that the misrepresentation of fact was made, or here not made by omission. There was something that, and that there was, it was untrue, that there was reliance, it was done with intent to induce, etc.
Right.
is that what you're saying, or is that not what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. It's not a duty in the sense that duty is an element of the tort of negligence. Duty is not an element of the tort of intentional misrepresentation. It's a sense of a duty to speak, which gives rise to which basically establishes the first element of the tort of intentional misrepresentation, and that's misrepresentation itself. Here, the legal duty protected or addressed by intentional misrepresentation is a duty to be honest. It's a duty not to deceive. And that this court would not be creating by affirming the verdict in this instance. It'd be recognizing that employers too must treat employees in the employment situation honestly and fairly, and they cannot withhold information from them specifically when that information is requested, and specifically when they know that the information, if provided to the employee, may give the employee reason to exercise his at-will freedom to seek employment elsewhere.
Counsel, I'm going back, I hate to, go back on this same path, but if I understand this, and you correct me if I'm wrong, there was this conversation in 87, and McKenzie stayed at a level 14 from 87 until 93. Is that right or wrong? Just so if my facts are incorrect, I want to know it. In other words, he stayed at that same level. There was talk about it in 87, so for practically 6 years, he stayed at the same grade.
I don't want to answer this question incorrectly. In as late as 1989, his position was downgraded to a 13. He retained the benefits of a 14 up until January 1 in 1993 when he lost
including his stock options?
Yes, Your Honor.
So
but the impact, I'm sorry, Judge, but the impact on Mr. McKenzie and the reason the claim was brought and the reason we're here today is that if he would have been told that his position was downgraded, he would have sought employment elsewhere, because a Miller Brewing Company at that particular level, like in any corporate structure, closer you get to the top, any time your position is diminished, that's a clear signal you will not proceed further. And it was Mr. McKenzie's objective, his career goal, to become a director at Miller, which was at grade 15. If he had been told he had been reduced from his position had been reduced from a 14 to a 13 at his age and at his position in the company, that would have clearly told him his career at Miller was foreclosed. He would not advance any further. And the evidence board bears that out.
How old was he in 1987?
44, Your Honor. 87? Yes, 44. My light's on.
May I ask a question? In the Court of Appeals opinion, paragraph 12, it says in May 1989, Miller Brewing evaluated the grade levels of hundreds of employees. Ultimately, 835 employees were in job classifications assigned lower grade levels. Does the record indicate how many of those 835 received notices that they had been downgraded?
No, the only thing in the record was that in 1989, when Mr. McKenzie was actually downgraded on the books, this processing started in 1988, that two of his staff members that reported to him were downgraded, and he notified them.
Isn't it more accurate to say that the positions were downgraded? McKenzie was not downgraded.
That is more accurate. It's just correct.
And does that make any difference here?
No, it does not.
Why not?
Because the fact that his position was downgraded was the message that would have sent to him in 1987 if he had been told about it. 1989, when it occurred, he would have sought employment elsewhere. The message would have been clear. His career at Miller, the advancement at Miller, would have been foreclosed, and he would have pursued other career options, as so found by the jury. Oh, thank you.
You say that, but then in 1992, he had an opportunity for an advancement, didn't he?
He did, Your Honor.
And he didn't get it.
Well, no, that was the tortious interference claim of Mr. Smith.
Right, I understand that.
At the time, he was told of the downgrade in 1992. He was working on a task force reorganization of the department, at which time a new department would be created, which would have necessarily taken him as well. He would have ended up under another director, and he was in line to beat the downgrade, if you will.
Thank you, Mr. Whitcomb. You will have 5 minutes in... Mr. Boyle will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Whitcomb will. Okay. Mr. Casey, according to my notes, you will have 15 minutes, and Mr. Daly will have 15 minutes. Tell us how you're going to divide the argument so we try and ask you the appropriate question.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abrahamson. I am John Casey. Mr. Daly and I intended to split the argument. Mr. Daly was going to be Mr. Law, and Mr. Casey, who had the privilege of participating throughout the trial, was going to be Mr. Fact. I've listened to the question, and Mr. Daly was going to start. But we didn't talk much about law during Mr. Whitcomb's presentation, and the court seems to be interested in the facts, and as between the two of us, I'm the guy, and I'd be pleased to discuss some of the facts. But where I'd like to start is exactly what the court was asking with respect to this existence of a duty. Because from a motion to dismiss, to a motion for summary judgment, to post-verdict, through the jury instruction phase, through post-verdict argument, and through the Court of Appeals, Miller Brewing Company has consistently taken the position that the issue of duty to disclose is a matter of law for the court to decide. And it remains Miller Brewing Company's and Robert Smith's position that that is a legal issue for the court to decide. And
what about the jury instructions? 2401 says a duty, it says even by a silence, if there's a duty to speak may arise, blah, blah, blah. And then there's a citation to Killeen versus Parent.
Right.
23 was second to 40.
There can be a duty, and there were issues, there did develop facts during the course of the trial that might have allowed it to go to a jury, but it did not happen that way. The duty elements, of course, for negligent misrepresentation or negligent non-disclosure of material facts requires the same remaining four elements.
But this is not negligent. I know we talk about duty in negligence, but when you talk about intentional misrepresentation, we're not talking about a duty. We're talking about that if you do make a misrepresentation, doesn't matter if I talk to you on the street and make a misrepresentation and you, I know you're going to rely on it and you rely on it to your detriment, you can sue me.
Now, Your Honor, you're getting back to what Mr. Daly was going to talk about,
right,
but I'd be pleased to address it.
No,
I'd like to suggest, Your Honor, that in this instance, remembering that Mr. McKenzie was attempting to prosecute a tort claim, and it is the position of the defendants in this case that if there is a duty, you must look to the lifeline, to the contract, to see what duty there may be.
Well, there may be a duty here arising, and I don't want to, that's why I asked how you're splitting the argument. There may be a duty arising here. Miller did speak through Smith, and Miller is liable through Smith. And Smith said, no downgrade.
Smith told the truth.
That may be, but was there enough evidence, credible evidence here for the jury to say Ms. Smith didn't tell the truth?
No. In fact, there was no evidence on that subject.
Wasn't there testimony by Mr. McKenzie that, in fact, he had been lied to?
The operative facts are substantially not in dispute. Mr. McKenzie, in 1987, when he learned that Bill Glickert came into the department and took over a substantial portion of his job responsibilities, Mr. McKenzie asked his supervisor, Robert Smith, will this affect my grade levels? Mr. McKenzie, at that time, was a 14. He had been a 14 since 1982. Mr. Smith said, no, it will not affect your grade level, and told the truth. Your Honor, I marked as a blow-up, and the court has before it,
a copy of Trial Exhibit Number 3.
We're going to have you have a microphone. Okay. And the court has before it a typed or duplicated version of what you have there, right?
Okay. That is correct, Your Honor. Trial Exhibit Number 3 is a July 1989 memorandum authored by Robert Smith, R.L. Smith, the person that made the statement in 1987 to Mr. McKenzie regarding his grade level, that it would not be affected. 2 years later, in 1989, when the Hayes study is performed in Miller Brewing Company and the position is evaluated, and the personnel department says, no, because Mr. McKenzie, as Mr. Smith says in the second paragraph, lost some supervisory responsibilities, the position is now a 13. But look what Mr. Smith thought in 1989. And he protested the re-evaluation of the position from a 14 to a 13. And he recommended to the Hay people, this should be a 14. Now put that in context of what Mr. Smith said in 1987 when asked, will this affect your grade level? And Mr. Smith said no. Mr. Smith in 1987 legitimately believed, and it's documented, this isn't any hokum smokum prepared for litigation, this is what he said in 1989, that the position was a 14. So not only did Mr. Smith tell Mr. McKenzie the absolute truth in 1987, it was his honest belief in 1987 that the position was a 14 and should remain a 14, and he fought for that position. It eliminates that element of the tort, requiring an intent to mislead. Neither Miller Brewing Company nor Robert Smith had any intent to mislead, and the trial exhibit number 3 is irrefutable on that subject. If I might, by the way, and of course, Mr. McKenzie did remain a 14 through January 1 of 1993, at which time he, not his position, but he was reduced to a grade level 13. And he was told that on August 17, 1992, in a written memorandum that he received. So Miller Brewing Company, when he was affected himself, he was told. So there was no mistake.
May I ask?
Justice Prosser.
As I understand your position, you're saying that what Mr. Smith said to Mr. McKenzie in 1987, as proved by this document, was completely accurate and a good faith representation. What about as of 8/8/89, however? At that point, he must have known that the information that he gave 2 years earlier was no longer viable.
If he had perfect recall, he might have remembered that 2 years earlier he had had a discussion on that. There was conflicting testimony, and I understand the standard of review on evidence. Mr. McKenzie's testimony was he was not told and didn't know about the downgrading of his position until August 17, 1992. Robert Smith's trial testimony was, in the ordinary course, he would have told, he thinks he did. The candid responses, and based on the record before this court, I think it must accept that Mr. McKenzie was not told that his position had been downgraded until 1992, but it's a so what, because he always retained all of those perks.
What happens if you're downgraded to a 13?
If you are, or your position is?
Well, you said in 93 he was.
In 93, and the interesting thing in 93 is he was himself placed in the position of a 13, but what was the impact? No salary change. The only impact, in fact, was he lost stock options.
Oh, but wasn't there a much greater impact? And that is that
he was no longer in the upward mobile, shall we say, track to upper management.
That's the kiss of death theory that has been projected. It's wrong, and it's wrong for three reasons. First of all, there was a trial exhibit. It's exhibit number 44, where in 1995 a computer run was generated to demonstrate what happens to a person's career track when at some point in your career your position is downgraded and you are downgraded. And there were 30, well, the statistics are there. There were individuals that went from 9 to 8, and by 1995 were all the way up to 12. There were 33 people downgraded, in fact downgraded in 1992, who by 1995, when the computer run was made, had moved up one position. There were several that moved up two, several that moved up three, and several that moved up four. So it's not the kiss of death. Mr. Robert Smits, that ends with a Z, testified at trial. Smits was the guy in HR that was responsible for attempting to slot people into positions that open up from internally, from lower executives. He was asked, in your role as human resource manager supporting executives slotting people in Miller Brewing Company, did the fact that a candidate may have been grandfathered at some point in their career negatively impact consideration for advancement? The person that's on the job and whose job it is answered, absolutely not. There's a big difference between being grandfathered and being demoted. A demotion normally occurs as a result of somebody demonstrating they're not capable to perform the job they've been assigned. Under those circumstances, it would probably impact. But if a job is downgraded, it's simply a reflection of what happened to the job, not a reflection of the person. That was two. The third, and I think the most telling point on this, what happens when you're downgraded, was Mr. McKenzie's own claim brought against Robert Smith, that Smith torpedoed his promotion to this director position. He was on a Boston Consulting Group study. He thought he was slotted to become a 15 or a 16 director. He claimed that but for Smith's tortious interference, he would have received that position. That assertion obviously flies directly in the face of the kiss of death theory that he advanced. He appealed that decision through the Court of Appeals, lost there, and has abandoned that claim now. So that's dead meat. But it shows that this kiss of death downgrading doesn't exist except and only in the mind of Gerald McKenzie. I have one other... Yes, sir?
Could I ask you about the 835 employees? What was the normal way, if you know and if it's in the record, of notifying people that their positions had been downgraded?
I believe that Mr. Whitcomb accurately described the record on that subject, and that in the instance of Gerald McKenzie, he was told that two subordinates reporting to him were being downgraded, and he reported that information to those candidates. Mr. Smith was advised that Mr. McKenzie was being his position was being downgraded. Mr. Smith's testimony was that he told McKenzie. McKenzie's testimony, I'm talking 1989, McKenzie's testimony was he was not told, and I don't think, as I said, that finding can really withstand this review.
The jury could have believed either one of them, McKenzie or Smith.
At that, as to what happened in 1989, but the underlying fact that there was no change in position is not subject to attack.
Well, apparently Miller thought that they should advise people that there was a downgrade, that they had a duty, or at least took it upon themselves to advise people.
I think it's a management choice.
Well, Smith told his subordinates.
He didn't tell McKenzie. Either he did or he didn't.
I'm sorry, McKenzie told his subordinates.
That seems to be the case.
And so one would assume that McKenzie thought that was the... corporate posture to tell subordinates, and that he therefore would have thought, or our jury could infer, that McKenzie should have told Smith, and he didn't.
Smithfield McKenzie?
I'm sorry. I beg your pardon. Ms. Smith should have told McKenzie.
I mean, I don't think you can...
Why couldn't a jury infer that?
That there would be an assumption that that would happen and pay $24.5 million on that assumption? I don't think so.
That's another issue, counsel. Let's stay with what the corporate...
I don't think there's anything in the record that establishes a corporate policy on that subject.
But, counsel, as I was listening to your argument as a follow-up of the chief, I heard you saying it's good news. Look, it's good news that he was demoted, not exaggeration for emphasis. But you were saying you can go from a 9 to an 8 and you end up with a 12. Well, I'll tell you. I mean, I think a jury could reasonably infer that it's not such good news, regardless of what the human resources person testifies to.
I don't disagree that being downgraded may constitute bad news, but it's not a career-ending move, and that's the essence of McKenzie's claim, is that had I known, I would have done something, but
Well, let me ask, it seems to me that a jury could reasonably infer that, though.
That it was bad news?
Not that it was bad news, that more than that it was bad news, that there was some kind of reliance and some kind of duty to be told when other people were told of that?
Not when you go back and look at the nature of the employment contract. Now you're trying to, this court is suggesting that there should exist a tort duty of disclosure in the employment contract context. And that is where, and that's where the Court of Appeals comes down on the law side of this one. It's the old one, too. And McKenzie loses one, he loses two, and he also loses three, by the way. He loses on public policy. A policy that would impose this kind of an obligation on employers and presumably a reciprocal obligation on employees to disclose all of this kind of information is unworkable, unreasonable, and not in, and certainly I don't believe this court, given the legislature's activity in the area of describing where things should and should not be disclosed, should now come up with a retroactive duty to disclose this kind of information.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from Mr. Daly. Attorney Daly.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I'm Frank Daly. I'm privileged and proud to represent the people of Miller, and Mr. Bolin, the president of Miller, is here, and Patty Best is with us as well. You know, I worked in this day. I started out as the leadoff hitter, and I've been demoted to the batting order. I'm not sure whether it's to the cleanup spot or whether I'm batting in the pitcher's spot. But
Casey was at bat.
Casey was at bat, and hopefully did not strike out. I don't intend to. I wanted to address particularly this issue about the Taji case, the issue about whether in this context an employer has a duty. We've talked about the duty. In effect, Mr. McKenzie argues for a law that would require an employee to an employer to presuppose, to try to presume what information might be important to an employee, and at that point have a duty to disclose. Your Honor, I think it's sound public policy to note that the at-will doctrine of employment that has been alive and well in our state since 1871. It served us well. It allows for flexibility. It allows employers to make sound business judgments about their employees, about the management of their company, and this governs Ma and Pa hardware stores in northern Wisconsin. It governs large companies, and it governs everybody in between. At the same time, that doctrine importantly provides employees with that flexibility. And here is the perfect example. Mr. McKenzie would tell you that, oh, if I had only known I was downgraded, I would have gone out and sought employment because I was had enormous talent. I had great experience in the brewing industry. I could have gone to Anheuser-Busch or Coors. I could have taken all of that knowledge and all of Miller's secrets with me, and I could have gone and gotten a great job. And Miller would not have had recourse if that happened because he was an employee at will. He had no duty to disclose to Miller that he was looking for another job, that he was talking to competitors, that he was actively seeking that on the street. And so, too, would be a whole panoply of other positions that an employee might have to take. An employee might have marital difficulties, physical problems, mental difficulties, which would affect their ability to perform, and yet there's no duty under the at-will doctrine for them to disclose that to their employer.
But aren't we dealing here with more than simply a duty to disclose? I accept everything that you've said, Mr. Daly.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But here the claim is that there was an intentional misrepresentation made in 1987. And at least as I see it, maybe I see the case incorrectly, as I see it, what McKenzie is now claiming is that once I was given this wrong information, even though Miller may not have had a duty to disclose about my downgrading in the absence of incorrect information, once I was given that incorrect information, there was a duty to correct that. That's how I see the theory of the case here for the plaintiff. Now, assume, I know this is a difficult assumption for you to make, but assume that there was an intentional misrepresentation made in 1987 by Mr. Smith. Just assuming that. Is there, as a matter of law, a duty on the part of Miller to correct that misinformation?
Not a duty of torts, Your Honor. I believe that it's clear from the entire discussion we've had that all of this dispute arises out of the employment of Mr. McKenzie by the Miller Brewing Company. It clearly finds its lifeline, it finds its genesis in the employment context. And under that kind of an assumption, which is accurate, the employer and under Wisconsin law, under Taji and his progeny, there is no duty, there is no tort duty to disclose. There may be a cause of action for breach of contract, for breach of the employment contract. Mr. McKenzie made a very specific election of remedies. He specifically chose not to pursue a contract remedy. Why? Because tort allowed him to get not only compensatory, but the possibility of punitive damages.
Well, what would his remedy have been under a contract?
Well, Your Honor, I think he may have had a contractual remedy. It's talked about an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, that what happened was not fair dealing. He may have had that, but in this context, in an at-will...
Not likely under an at-will.
Well, the at-will doctrine has served us well. It's provided for this flexibility, and under that doctrine, under your decision in Taji, I think it's clear that the employer does not have...
Taji was negligent representation.
I understand.
No, I'm sorry, it was negligent, yes, not intentional.
Correct. But I think, Your Honor, in either situation... there has to be a duty independent of the employment relationship, and that's what's not shown
here.
That's
your real point.
It is indeed, and I think it's supported by the law here, and also by the court's reference to the fact that despite the literally boxes of briefs and materials that have been shipped to you and have been cited to you, there isn't one citation anyplace by anybody that any court anywhere in the United States of America has ever held that there was a duty to disclose information to an employee in an employment context.
But that's not the claim here.
Pardon me?
With all respect, I don't think that is the posture of this case. And the cases to the effect that you cite are, I'm sure, very accurate, but they're inapposite to this case, because it seems to me the theory here is, once there has been an intentional misrepresentation, there arises a duty on the part of the employer to correct that misinformation. And their silence served as essentially a misrepresentation.
I understand that theory, Your Honor, but in the context of this case, factually, there was no misrepresentation.
You're attacking the base of my hypothesis. And
sure, yeah, because the premise, if the first premise is wrong, you know, the conclusion is wrong. And that's wrong. There was no misrepresentation. Nobody ever lied to Mr. McKenzie. Nobody ever intentionally withheld information.
Mr. McKenzie claimed that he thought he was lied to in 1987. And he told that to the jury, didn't he?
I think he probably did. Again, this is Mr. Fact, and I feel uncomfortable being called Mr. Law, but I'll accept the accolades of my partner. But what's really worth the focus that we know objectively, regardless of what Mr. McKenzie was, I mean, a cause of action can't be created in a person's mind because they don't have a cause of action because they think they've been lied to, if objectively they have not. And we know objectively that in 1987, Mr. Smith did not misrepresent anything. The Hayes study had even been commissioned. So what he told them was completely accurate. And Mr. McKenzie's employment, which is what his big complaint is about his damages, and we suggest, Your Honor, he didn't prove his damages anyway. He proved damages for termination of a contract, as the exhibit that I think we've given that shows, that all of his damages were approved for termination of his employment, not for the tortious interference or other aspects. But the important thing to focus on here is that Mr. McKenzie did absolutely nothing to suggest that he at any time was going to seek employment other than with Miller. Miller's a great employer. He would have a very difficult time finding anybody in the industry to compensate him as well, and he made no attempt to find other employment, not in 1987, not in 1989. And in 1989, when he is specifically advised that he's got to tell people that report to him that their positions have been downgraded, a reasonable person under the same circumstances would most probably ask, gosh, am I going to be downgraded now? And he didn't. There was silence on his part. When he found out that he had been downgraded, he did not go out and look for employment. His employment at Miller was terminated not because his grade level was reduced, but because of his unseemly misconduct on several instances and his very bad judgment. So the gravamen of his complaint has no basis. And if we're in a situation where an employee upon termination can think back and think, gosh, maybe they didn't disclose something to me, the floodgates are open because every disgruntled employee can get revenge. And what a great way to get revenge for a woman who expressed some concern about some sexual innuendos and misconduct, and her penalty for that is to get hit with a $1.5 million judgment. That sends the wrong message. That's not the message that our courts in Wisconsin send.
Counsel, perhaps Exhibit 3 is irrelevant, because and what was said in 1987 may have been true at the time, but as time evolved, Miller and Smith knew that indeed the position and the person were going to be downgraded.
Justice Brown, I understand the important thing is that when Miller knew that McKenzie himself was going to be downgraded, they advised him of that immediately. In fact, they advised him of it months before it actually occurred. So,
but they didn't advise him of the, it's his contention, and the jury could reasonably infer it to be true, but they did not timely advise him when they knew of the downgrade of the position. Right?
When they knew of the downgrade of his own position?
Mr. McKenzie notified his subordinates, but no one notified him.
Mr. McKenzie says that they didn't tell him there was dispute. Yes, the jury could infer that.
Why?
He certainly would, a reasonable person in the same circumstances, Your Honor, I think, would ask that question. If he didn't, he didn't. But the record, I think,
is clear that under the situation, nobody ever lied to him. Nobody withheld information. And even the information about a downgrade was readily available to him. There was no concealment. There was no active plan by anybody to preclude Mr. McKenzie from having whatever information he felt was necessary.
When was he downgraded to a 13?
He personally, Your Honor?
Yeah.
He got the memo in August of 1992, and it became effective in January of 1993.
Okay, so he wasn't claiming that he was actually downgraded in 1989?
Well, I don't believe he is, and I don't think the record would show that, Your Honor. His position was, which simply meant this, that if Mr. McKenzie moved up or moved down, whoever moved into the position that he had vacated, either upward mobility or going down, the person that would then be brought into that grade level would be a 13 instead of a 14. But it did not affect Mr. McKenzie in 1989 in any way. He kept all of his benefits. He was a grade 14. He was grandfathered. And as the record reflects, and as Justice Prosser referred to, there were literally hundreds and hundreds of employees at Miller whose positions were reevaluated as part of the overall management consulting plan, which is certainly well within the business judgment rule of what an employer needs to do to look at his company. And nobody else complained. Nobody else suggested that moving a grade level down or two levels down constituted some interference with their contract or was the kiss of death for them. And it wasn't the kiss of death for Mr. McKenzie. The kiss of death for him was his improper behavior and his poor judgment. That's where the basis of
Mr. Daly, I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
A number of arguments have been made in these briefs about if the employer had a duty imposed on it to disclose information to employees, that there is, it's hard to know where that would stop.
Yes, Your Honor.
The flip side is, what can an employer say to an employee? Is there anything that an employer cannot say to an employee?
Cannot say?
Yeah. Without creating the support of intentional misrepresentation?
Well, I think certainly an employer has a right to maintain some confidentiality of some information that may be critical to the company, but the statutes, the legislature, which Your Honor is well familiar with, has created a whole variety of areas in which employers have a duty to disclose specific information, such as the right to know law, where employees have to be told that they're working with chemicals or with toxins, and such as the open record law with respect to personnel files. But the statutes of Wisconsin and the legislature, its wisdom, specified that, but at the same time exempted from disclosure to employees the very kind of information which Mr. McKenzie says he was deprived of. That legislative policy has served the state of Wisconsin well. It provides employers with a solid set of rules as far as what their responsibilities are, what information they have a duty to disclose. It provides the employees with the ability to know what rights they have in terms of what kind of information they're entitled to. Beyond that, Your Honor, I think it opens up, I think as Justice Day called it, we have to be careful that we don't open up Pandora's box just because it has attractive wrapping paper on it. Yeah, and I would subscribe to that. This may have the points, literally attractive wrapping paper, not to me, but to some. But if we did, we have essentially, this court would be creating chaos in the workplace by providing a rule of law which essentially imposes an impossible burden on an employer to try to divine in every situation what information is important to the employee, what information the employee himself thinks is important to him or her in the advancement of their career, and at the same time would impose, in fairness, similar requirements and duties to disclose on employees for information that at this point they do not have to disclose.
Counsel, go ahead. Why are you talking about facts as you did earlier, as Mr. Law? Why don't you just say, Tachi, and that's it? I mean, what is wrong? There must be something wrong with Tachi.
Oh, I don't think there's anything wrong with Tachi, Your Honor. I think it's dispositive. But I don't want to be just known as a one-dimensional player.
Oh,
I'd like to get a little facts into the law.
Your Honor, it's our position without, I want to be very clear about one thing, that for sure Miller is honest with its employees, it tells its employees things. There was no lie in this case. There was no reliance on any failure to disclose. The Court of Appeals majority opinion is the right opinion. It should be affirmed by this court. That's the fair result and the just result. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Daly?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. I read Herbert Eisenberg's Fraud in the Employment Context, which is referred to.
I commend your patience and diligence, Your Honor.
I read it fast. And it looks at cases, and most of them are fraudulent inducement to enter into the employment contract.
Correct, Your Honor.
You accept those cases?
I accept those cases.
There's one case, only one that at least stuck out. Mafia v. Bancassi, it's a New York case, federal district in New York, reversed on other grounds. But the court found that the jury had ample record to support the finding that the employer had made promises to the employee regarding promotion and job security, inducing him to turn down other alternative employment with other employers. And the court therefore found sufficient support in the record for a determination that the promises were preconceived and undisclosed intention not to perform them. So it was a fraudulent representation to induce him to stay.
Well,
now, that leads me to the amicus brief of the Human Resources Management Association, which, if I understood it, took the position that if you're going to have a tort of fraudulent inducement to stay, that you'd have to show more reliance than Mr. McKenzie said. What do you think of that theory?
I think it's an accurate theory. I think that in order to obviously have any kind of tort, there has to be some reliance. There has to be something done in reliance on it. And again, because it's such an amorphous concept that if you don't tell somebody, then that person, if they had that knowledge, may have looked for another job at some time, at some place. Under the facts of this case, Your Honor, it really doesn't apply because there is absolutely no evidence to support a suggestion that Mr. McKenzie made any attempt to find other employment or turn down any employment or had any promises made to him which would have dissuaded him from seeking employment elsewhere.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Daly. Mr. Woodcomb?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll make my points quickly. There's a lot to address here. First, if you do the Tatchy analysis, there's no distinction between fraud in the inducement in employment and fraud in the continuation of employment. Because the teaching of Tatchy, when you also consider the Landwehr case and the Allman case, is that if you ignore the contract and determine whether or not an independent duty arises, that is when you can bring the tort action. Well, in the context, there should be no distinction between fraud in the inducement and fraud in the continuation because you ignore the contract. And ignoring the contract, there is an independent duty not to commit intentional fraud.
Excuse me, if I could interrupt for a minute. Your damages evidence was all presented on a contract measure, was it not? A contract measure of damages instead of a misrepresentation measure of damages?
No, there are consequential damages. Lost earning capacity subsequent to the time he left Miller. I mean, there wasn't the...
What is the proper measure of damages in a misrepresentation case?
Unrelated to property, what we did in this particular case, and that's consequential damages based upon the injury that had occurred due to the misrepresentation, and in this case was lost employment opportunities. Customarily, these intentional misrepresentation cases involve real property, and then the rule of damages of benefit of a bargain. We discussed that in conference, and it was concluded by the court over the objection of the plaintiff, of the defendants, that the benefit of the bargain instruction to the jury would confuse them more than help them, so we used the general damage instruction.
Is it your position that, and I'm just looking at Tatchy, on page 108 in paragraph 4, footnote 4, that we would, this goes hand in hand with the Tatchy case, or would we have to overrule Tatchy?
Oh, I don't think you have to overrule Tatchy at all. I don't think, Judge Justice, that in the law, as a matter of law, you can ever conclude that an intentional tort is inextricably intertwined with the contract so as to preclude a tort action. And Tapke was a negligence action.
Counsel, are you finished answering that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, I need to get back to what I think is, for me anyway, one of the crucial underpinnings of this case. It's a very difficult case. I have not read the record yet. And that's this. For you to prevail, it seems to me, for you to hit the home run, you've got to touch first base first. And first base is the intentional misrepresentation claim of Mr. McKenzie that he said occurred in 1987.
Yes, Your
Honor. You heard Mr. Daly and Mr. Fax and Mr. Law say that everything that was told him in 1987 was true.
Well, that is for the jury to believe, and it's
well, let me finish the question.
Thank you.
And I know that your position is that Mr. McKenzie believed that he was lied to in 1987. So I accept for purposes of my question that Mr. McKenzie's statement that he believed he was lied to is insufficient. That's not a fact. That's a conclusion. So what are the facts? And this is a critical question. What are the facts that you rely on in the record to support your claim that Mr. McKenzie was lied to in 1987?
It's from Mr. Smith's own words.
Okay.
By answer to the complaint in this action and by answer to an interrogatory. And I'll quote it for you. The interrogatory question was, identify who advised plaintiff that his grade level 14 position had been grandfathered. Answer, Robert L. Smith. Interrogatory. For each person identified in your answer, please provide the following information. Date, plaintiff is so advised. If he's advised in writing, identify the document. If advised orally, identify the conversation. Answer, Robert L. Smith recalls at the time William Glicker joined Miller Brewing Company, 1987. Mr. Smith spoke generally to his subordinates regarding a reorganization of the sales administration department and spoke privately to Mr. McKenzie regarding the effect of this reorganization on Mr. McKenzie, at which time Mr. Smith believes he informed Mr. McKenzie that his position had been grandfathered and that his income would not be adversely affected. Now the jury could conclude from that statement in 1987.
Can you give me the citation to the record first?
It's Exhibit 28.
Okay.
And you can also look at the answer to the complaint.
So, the gravamen of the statement you believe was that he said that he had been grandfathered in? Where's the intentional misrepresentation here in that statement?
The jury can reasonably infer from the interrogatory that, one, Mr. McKenzie was grandfathered in 1987. They could accept Mr. McKenzie's statement that he talked to Mr. Smith about, which Mr. Smith acknowledged in his interrogatory, and the issue for the jury to decide was whether or not Mr. McKenzie was telling the truth and not Mr. Smith when Mr. McKenzie said, I was not told I would be grandfathered.
Okay, but it was grandfathered to level 14, not level 13.
It was grandfathered at 14, down, the position was downgraded to 13.
In 1992. The point here is there has to be a misrepresentation made in 1987. And I can't figure out right now what that misrepresentation was. And even if Mr. Smith told Mr. McKenzie that he was grandfathered in 1987, that's not a misrepresentation. He was grandfathered in to a level 14. The misrepresentation, it seems to me, if there is one, would be for Mr. Smith to have said, you are, your grandfather being at level 14, and yet Mr. Smith knows, and Miller knows, that in fact he's been demoted to 13.
You must keep in
there's some kind of inference, some kind of facts to
you must keep in sight the reason for the deceit. And the reason for the deceit is Mr. Smith, as a jury reasonably inferred, didn't want Mr. McKenzie to leave. And he knew that if he would have been told his position had been downgraded, that Mr. McKenzie would have left. He wanted to keep Mr. McKenzie on the department. He did not want him to leave, and that's a reasonable inference that a jury could draw. I think the analysis for this court on that question is, one, in order to sustain the Court of Appeals on the evidence, my lights.
Go ahead, you may continue.
In order to sustain the Court of Appeals on the evidentiary finding, the court's going to have to make two conclusions. Number one, Judge Wiedemeyer's view of the evidence was unreasonable, and he found credible evidence to support the verdict. And number two, you're going to have to conclude that the trial court was clearly wrong that the evidence did not sustain the verdict, because that was the finding of the trial court. I believe there was sufficient evidence in the record to sustain the inferences to which the jury arrived at, and the real problem in this case in explaining it and discussing it with the court is what we had to do is we had to prove that Mr. Smith was lying about a lie. And that was the confusion that was created in the court, and that's the confusion in trying to explain it factually to this court.
Was lying about?
Lying about a lie.
Okay, so tell us what was, go back and give us each of those lies so we can just double back and understand your statement. It's another way of asking what Justice Babbage did. When did Smith first lie?
1987.
That the jury could believe it. Okay.
1987, when he told Mr. McKenzie his position had not been downgraded.
Okay, he told in 19, this is what the jury could believe, 1987, yes, that McKenzie's position was not downgraded.
Downgraded.
Okay. But that was true.
At the time the statement was made, right? His position had not been downgraded.
Well,
he had been downgraded.
We're using the term downgrade, or I'm using the term in that whether or not his position was affected.
Okay.
And the downgrade was not the crux of the case of Mr. McKenzie. What really harmed him was the fact that he knew he would progress no further at Miller. And no one at his grade level 14 who has downgraded ever was promoted again to 14 or above it. And that's in the evidence.
Well, you just introduced a very interesting fact here in response to Justice Sykes. Because I've always assumed the word downgraded meant went from level 14 to level 13, and it seems to be uncontradicted in the testimony that he was not downgraded from 14 to 13. Are you using the word downgraded in a different sense, to mean essentially that he was a ceiling, that the glass ceiling came down upon his head in 1987? And so, in fact, his job before, his job was affected. So the lie was not downgraded, but the lie was that his job was affected.
In company nomenclature, if your position is going to be affected, is it going to be, am I going to be downgraded? I mean, is it going to be affected? You're absolutely correct. His position was not effectively downgraded from benefits standpoint until January 1, 1993. It wasn't downgraded as far as being grandfathered on the books until May of 1989. However, in November of 1987, the jury could reasonably infer from the evidence that Smith knew at that time that the reorganization would affect his position, it would cause him to be grandfathered, and when McKenzie asked him, and he said no, he lied to him.
So the operative words that you claim as the misrepresentation, which are found in that Smith's response was, quote, it's not going to affect you at all.
Correct.
And Smith at that time, under your theory, knew that it was going to affect him.
Yes.
In other words, he was taken off the upward mobile track.
Yeah, and Smith did not want to lose him because he was working on two very important projects, and the benefit of which and the success of which reflected on Mr. Smith's performance evaluations.
Well, I think Justice Babbage covered it. The theory of the plaintiff's case then was that Mr. McKenzie's upward mobility at the company was affected in 1987, and the company, through Mr. Smith or somebody else, had a duty to tell him that.
Once asked. When he asked the question, is this reorganization in 1987 going to affect me, Smith knew it would, but he told him no. And in 1987, he would have been told that. As he testified, he would have sought employment elsewhere.
So it's really not an affirmative misrepresentation claim. It is a sin of omission rather than commission sort of misrepresentation claim,
there's
that the fraud has been characterized here.
There's sufficient evidence to, on either two theories to support the verdict by, entered, found by the jury.
And you're really relying, Judge Wiedemeyer summarizes that. That you're relying on.
Yes, very succinctly. As did the trial court when Judge Tessner sustained the verdict. She did a wonderful analysis of the evidence as well.
Justice Bradley. As I understand it, with regard to the facts, then, question one of the special verdict dealing with the 1987 misrepresentation was answered, did Mr. Smith make a representation of fact at any time that Gerald McKenzie's grade level was not affected by a 1987 reorganization? And the wording of that is, did Smith make a representation at any time that the grade level was not affected by a 1987 reorganization? The jury answered yes. Was such representation untrue? But yes. Question three, did Smith make the representation knowing it was untrue or recklessly without caring whether it was true or untrue? It seems to me, with regard to, and the jury answered yes, it seems to me that as answered by the jury, the first question is tied not to necessarily to a 1987 statement, but a statement made at any time regarding whether or not the 1987 reorganization was going to affect his grade level. Is that correct or incorrect?
At any time, there was a discussion between counsel as to whether or not to focus that question on a point in time, and the debate was, no, they could believe that the misrepresentation was in 87 and 89, or between 89 and 1992. There was enough evidence to support all three. Thus, the misrepresentation was about the effect of the reorganization in 87, but it was at any time. Whether it be in 87, 89, or 92, my life's been on for a while.
I know, but you're still at the podium, and Justice Babbage has a question.
I'm willing to answer the question.
I apologize for pounding this dead horse, but it's still sort of kicking for me. I asked you what facts on the record support the finding of intentional misrepresentation. And you're saying that the intentional misrepresentation was Mr. Smith saying to Mr. McKenzie that his job was not going to be affected at all, when in fact Mr. Smith knew that his job would be affected. Even though he was staying at level 14, that glass ceiling had come down upon his head.
The kiss of death, yes, Your Honor.
So, now, when I ask you, Darren, what facts do you rely on to support that? Now, you cited Exhibit 28.
To support the intent element?
No. To support the fact that the fact that you claim that this was an intentional misrepresentation. You read Exhibit 28 to me, which I wish I could put my hand on right now. Okay.
Did you draw it?
Yes.
May I approach the bench?
Of course. Is this the one that Wiedemeyer quotes? It's not going to affect you at all. Don't worry about it. You're very important to the company. You're making a good contribution. I really want to help, Mr. Glicker.
No, that's from testimony of trial, Your Honor.
Okay.
Now, at this is what it says here. He spoke that Smith recalls that he talked with his subordinates, etc., and he spoke privately to Mr. McKenzie regarding the effect of this reorganization on him, at which time Mr. Smith believes he informed Mr. McKenzie that his position had been grandfathered. But that's true, correct? His position had been grandfathered at level 14.
Correct.
And that his income would not be adversely affected. That's correct also.
His, in,
income was not adversely affected, right, when he was grandfathered.
And then the last statement, the last sentence of this exhibit, Mr. Smith recalls no further details regarding this conversation at this time. Counsel, I'm afraid, I just don't see it. What are the facts that you're relying on to show that Mr. Smith knew the position was going to be affected and he lied about it?
That's the lying about the lie about the lie. Mr. McKenzie testified he asked Mr. Smith in 1987 whether his position would be affected.
Right.
He testified that Smith said, no, it's not going to be affected. It's great for the company. Mr. Smith testified that he had no, that if he told McKenzie anything, he would have told him that, what you just read.
Okay.
The jury...
So the jury believed Mr. McKenzie.
Right.
Mr. McKenzie's statement that it was not going to be affected at all.
Correct.
Okay, and what facts do you have in the record? I feel very badly about taking my...
No, that's right.
What facts do you have in the record to support your belief, or Mr. McKenzie's belief, that Smith, at that time, knew his job was going to be affected, that this glass ceiling had come down over his head?
He was an executive. No one downgraded from position 14, which was McKenzie's position, never returned to that position, or was promoted beyond it. The fact that he didn't tell him or lie to him, a jury could raise the inference there's improper motivation behind it. Mr. McKenzie had testimony would reveal, knew and explained to Mr. Smith that it was his objective in the company to become a director, which was the next step up, step 15. Mr. Smith knew that. The jury could reasonably infer from that information and from the benefit that Mr. Smith or Mr. McKenzie provided to Mr. Smith and his department, he didn't want to lose Mr. McKenzie, but there wasn't anything necessarily he could do to affect the downgrade of his position, so he lied to him. The jury could reasonably infer all of that.
Could I briefly go back to the damages question once again, and I don't want to prolong this, but when I asked you the question earlier about the measure of damages, it seems to me, looking at Exhibit 16, that this is clearly a contract measure of damages that was submitted as an evidentiary matter to the jury, because the exhibit itself, and I know this doesn't tell the whole picture, but this exhibit refers to lost salary and benefits due to termination. And you said, no, that was a measure of his consequential damages as a result of misrepresentation in this case.
The damages Mr. McKenzie suffered on the misrepresentation claim substantially occurred post-termination, if you will. I mean, that was the label that the expert put on his documentation he provided to us. If you look at the entirety of Exhibit 16, the damage calculations for lost salary, lost benefits, and all of those don't have that due to termination listed on it, but those were also the damages which were being argued as to the damages caused by the intentional interference by Ms. Best, which caused his termination.
Okay, but what were your damages, or what was your measure of damages? What was your evidence on damages as a result of the misrepresentation claims?
His lost employment opportunities, and the jury reasonably inferred, as found by the trial court, that he would have continued, had he been told in 87, he would have found work similar to what he's been doing at Miller, and would have earned the same rate of pay as what he was earned at Miller, and that is what that chart indicates.
And there was testimony,
what would they have inferred that from if there wasn't an expert who testified to a proper misrepresentation measure of damages?
This is lost employment.
But there wasn't, you didn't call an expert, a vocational expert, for example, who came in and said, this is what upwardly mobile executives who had his level of experience and training would have earned in a comparable position with comparable upward employment opportunities at another company.
I believe Mr. Robert Cooper did do that, but he was a headhunter, if you will. He had an executive search company, and he did testify that Number one, Mr. McKenzie was far less marketable and probably not marketable at the age of termination as compared to the time in 1987, which, if he would have gone into the marketplace, would have found employment.
But that's, I don't know that that's a benefit of the bargain measure of damages, is it? He's talking about the damages stemming from the termination.
Well, the benefit of the bargain damages is it applies to misrepresentation in real estate. The measure of damages in misrepresentation cases is, I suppose you could use the analogy in this particular case, what a situation was at the time of injury and what the situation was for him after the injury. And in this instance, his damages was his inability to find employment comparable to what he was earning at Miller because of his age at the time he was told.
Chief? Are there any other questions? Justice Prosser.
This Exhibit 3 seems to stand in conflict with your theory of what was in Mr. Smith's mind. What is your rebuttal to Exhibit 3?
It's for the jury to determine. I think the jury could reasonably conclude that in 1987, regardless of whether or not on the books in the May of 1989, the position was, the number changed from 14 to 15. In 1987, the jury could reasonably infer that Smith knew because of the substantial reduction of Mr. McKenzie's responsibilities, his position, and he was going to be affected. And they can reasonably infer that indeed that was the kiss of death of the class ceiling, a glass ceiling for Mr. McKenzie, and failed to tell him about it. And that is what caused the injury, because by the time he knew it, he was too old to be marketable for a similar position in the marketplace, as found by the jury.
Well, you may sit down now. And that concludes our... Counsel.
I argue by taking record at 161, which was exactly what Mr. McKenzie asked Mr. Smith what Mr. Smith was on.
Thank you for your helpful comment, Mr. Daly. This concludes our argument in McKenzie versus Miller Brewing Company. We are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45.